today on Against the Grain. What is a humble substance like palm oil, which is in so many foods we eat and products we use, have to do with capitalism and imperialism? I'm CS. We'll re-present a conversation with Max Haven about his book Palm Oil, The Grease of Empire, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. We encounter it every day. It's in what we eat, what we apply to our skin. It's in constant use in manufacturing and industrial processes. And yet, we don't notice it. We don't give it a second thought. Along comes Max Haven, who has a lot to say about palm oil and the uses to which it's been put, it's being put, by corporations, governments, and empires. Grasping the history and development of palm oil production and use can tell us a lot, Haven contends, about how capitalism functions, how imperial and colonial states work, how workers get treated, and what's happening to the environment. Max Haven is a writer and teacher and Canada Research Chair in the Radical Imagination at Lakehead University in Thunder Bay, Canada. His new book is Palm Oil, The Grease of Empire. When Max and I connected recently, I asked him what palm oil is.
It is an oil derived from the oil palm. There are three typical varieties of oil palm, but one particular one that originated in Africa is the source of palm oil. Though the palm oil that we encounter every day is a highly bleached, deodorized, and refined variety that has been sort of industrially manufactured. Palm oil originated in West Africa, where it's been used for millennia as a foodstuff, a food staple, as a source of cosmetics, as a sacred sacrament in rituals, as an integral part of the economy. But it was sort of encountered by Europeans and transformed into the substance we know today in the 18th century. And that's really made it a key part of the growth and development of capitalism since that time, although one that we're usually unaware of because it's largely invisible.
In what sorts of products and materials might we find palm oil today as an ingredient?
It's almost easier to say which products don't have palm oil in them. It's in some 50% of supermarket products. So a lot of the time you might encounter it as a foodstuff. It might be an edible oil in prepackaged foods, cookies, biscuits, but also in things like coffee whitener, certain kind of dairy simulation products. It's sometimes used as a cooking oil for deep fried foods. It has a very high smoke point, so it might be in potato chips or other snack foods. But then you would also find it in the lion's share of laundry detergents, soaps, other cleaning products. You would find it in cosmetics, in makeup. It's often a carrier for medicines in pills and other sort of topical ointments. And then it could be an ingredient in many other things that are not so directly related. So it might be, for instance, used in inks or dyes or paints, or it might be an additive in a floor wax, or it might be found in a million other potential sort of applications. Sometimes elements that are derived from it could be emulsifiers or coagulants or sulfurcants or other preservatives that would go into processed foods or other products to increase their shelf life or make them more useful. So it really is practically everywhere. It's very difficult to avoid.
Before we dive into some of the history that you lay out in your book, Palm Oil, The Grease of Empire, how would you summarize the problem that palm oil poses in today's world?
Well, in brief, the production of palm oil around the world is a humanitarian and ecological catastrophe. Ecologically speaking, the clearing of forests in tropical regions to make way for palm oil plantations has led to some of the greatest clear-cutting and burning of forests anywhere in the world out of any industry. A lot of this has happened in Indonesia and Malaysia, which are today the palm oil superpowers, but it's also increasingly happening in West Africa, where palm oil originated, and also in Latin America, in Brazil, Colombia, Guatemala, Peru, and other nations. And the consequences are severe. The burning of forest and the degradation of biomass contributes to global warming by removing important carbon sinks and also releasing, through burning, carbon into the atmosphere. Palm oil manufacturing is singularly responsible for a huge amount of biodiversity loss within ecosystems, as well as poisoning of rivers and water tables. And then beyond that, the humanitarian consequences are also quite severe. I mean, ever since Europeans colonized palm oil production and began to move it around the world, it's been sort of the watchword for the exploitation of labor forces, especially migrant labor forces, often people who've been displaced by war, conflict, extraction of capitalism at earlier moments, who are now forced to work in palm oil industries, which are highly exploitative. Often making use of debt bondage up to this day, often making use of divide and conquer tactics to pit workers against each other, and often also workers suffer the ecological consequences and health consequences of being sprayed with pesticides, herbicides, and other toxic chemicals. So in many ways, the industry that brings us palm oil is an extremely destructive one. And beyond those forms of destructiveness, there's also bigger problems, which perhaps we'll return to in this conversation, about what happens when a commodity like palm oil becomes so cheap or cheapened that it begins to replace the way that communities have engaged with fat and oil for centuries in traditional ways. And it's actually leading to very catastrophic health impacts, as well as increasing dependency on international markets for many people in many communities.
You begin your book with the story of the British Empire's punitive expedition. I mean, that's what it's called, punitive expedition, against a kingdom, the Edo Kingdom, in what is today Nigeria. And this was in 1897. The British destroyed that once powerful kingdom. And this led to the British theft of what would come to be known as the Benin Bronzes. These are priceless artifacts still held in many Western museums and collections. The Nigerian government is trying to reclaim and repatriate these artifacts. But you point out that the objective of this British expedition, 1897, was not to steal the artifacts, but rather to secure the kingdom, the Edo Kingdom's formidable palm oil production capacity. Tell us about this and why you chose to begin your book with this example, this story.
I'm perhaps a bit of a tourist in the study of palm oil. You know, I'm not an expert in its history, but I began teaching about material culture and the history of capitalism to students at a fine art university in Halifax, Canada, about 10 years ago, and needed an example that they would all recognize from their own lives, something that they touched every day, that they could use to enter into the shared history of the planet and the way that that's been mediated and shaped by capitalism and colonialism. And through that, I came to palm oil, and through the story of palm oil, I came to this story of the punitive expedition, which happened sort of late in the colonial process in Africa. What essentially had happened is early in the 19th century, the slave trade had been abolished, and Liverpool merchants who had made their fortune in that heinous form of commerce were looking for a new commodity to focus their investment and energy on. And they came across palm oil, as well as ivory and later rubber, as commodities that they could extract from Africa for European markets. And following the Berlin conference that happened about a decade before the punitive expedition that kind of carved up Africa between different imperial European powers, The British slowly moved to eliminate any threats or disturbances or any countervailing powers to their authority within West Africa and the territories we now know as Nigeria, although at that time they were tellingly called the oil rivers, and that was for palm oil rather than petroleum, although petroleum would be discovered there at a later date. So the British had a deep interest in controlling the economy of palm oil, and as the century progressed, they ceased to be content to simply stay on ships at the mouths of rivers and trade for palm oil that Africans themselves were manufacturing and cultivating, and instead began to invade further and further inland and take control of plantations themselves, attempting to institute and impose industrialized forms of plantation agriculture on African people. And for this reason, they destroyed many, many African kingdoms and communities, including the Edo Kingdom, although the Edo Kingdom, because it was so far inland, was able to withstand for quite a long time. The British did so in order to make sure that palm oil would continue to flow cheaply into Europe, where it literally and figuratively sort of greased the wheels of the Industrial Revolution.
Max Haven joins me on Against the Grain. I'm C.S. Song. He is a writer, teacher, and Canada Research Chair in the Radical Imagination at Lakehead University in Ontario, Canada. We're talking about his new book, Palm Oil, The Grease of Empire. It's published by Pluto Press. It's part of that publishing house's Vagabonds series. You write that the 1897 expedition, again, this British expedition against the Edo Kingdom in what is Nigeria today, was justified and sold to the British public in part as necessary to end the barbaric practice of human sacrifice. Did this kingdom, in fact, practice human sacrifice?
Yes, they did, although historians are somewhat split on how to understand that human sacrifice. On the one hand, you have those historians who take British accounts of these practices at face value and see this as a form of human sacrifice practiced by the elites of the Edo Kingdom as a way to intimidate and dominate vassal states, enslaved people, and lower class or caste people within that society. And they were undertaken as religious rites that reinforced the power of the elite. Other historians suggest that perhaps this should be seen as closer to capital punishment, which is something the British Empire practiced at that time, and the American Empire still practices, the punishment of people whose behaviors have been criminalized for really heinous acts. So the jury is out in some ways. Historians debate this case. My argument in the book, however, is that sometimes the depiction of human sacrifice, especially in the salacious and racist press of England at the time, does a certain work. I mean, on one level, it might be familiar to students of history in our own age who recognize the way that in order to justify an imperial intervention, you have to vilify and indeed demonize the people whose land is going to be invaded. So human sacrifice here functioned to do that. And also something familiar from our own age, the vilification and demonization of the other helps distract the imperialist from their own barbaric and demonic practices. So, you know, in the British Empire at this time, as I mentioned, capital punishment was still in effect. But beyond that, the British Empire was certainly a empire of human sacrifice. Millions of people died in the interests of British capitalism in India, in China, in Africa, and elsewhere around the world, so that the British Empire would take it upon itself to step in and save the people of the Edo Kingdom from a sacrificial empire was in some ways ironic, if not hypocritical.
And why is this theme of human sacrifice central to the story you want to tell about specifically palm oil?
Palm oil, the palm oil industry, like so many industries of today's form of global neo-colonial racial capitalism, is a sacrificial industry. Millions of lives are sacrificed every year on the altar of the palm oil industry's ability to provide the world with this artificially cheapened commodity, a commodity that becomes cheap through the exploitation of people and the planet. So ultimately, I'm interested in the way that human sacrifice persists to this day, but in different forms. In many civilizations, human sacrifice is justified through a religious argument. You know, if the elites of a society didn't perform human sacrifices, then the gods would be angered or the gods would go hungry and great calamity would ensue to all sorts of people. You know, so the sacrifice of an individual or even hundreds of people on the altar of this or that god is a price worth paying for peace, tranquility. That's at least the surface justification. Other arguments suggest that in societies that practice human sacrifice, the real reason is that it's a tool used by elites to maintain their power. It's a convenient way of intimidating your enemies and getting rid of your enemies if you have to. My argument throughout the book is that our society is not that different. We also have a strange and vengeful god that we worship called the markets. And in the name of pleasing the market, we are willing to countenance many, many different forms of human sacrifice, and also the sacrifice of the more than human world as well. And we justify this by saying that if we didn't allow the market to do its work, if we intervened in the market, if we tried to limit the market, we would actually be doing more harm than good, because we would interrupt and jeopardize the source of economic growth, which inevitably will make things better for everyone. We'll jeopardize the spirit of scientific innovation, which will make the world better for everyone. But how different is that from the justifications that elites in other societies have used to justify human sacrifice? And further, I mean, it might not be too much of a stretch to imagine that in this world that we live in, the fact that so many of our fellow humans around the planet are subjected to these forms of economic sacrifice also has a kind of propagandistic or ideological work. It makes the rest of us very afraid that we too will become the sacrificial victims of capitalism. And in fact, I think we can speak about and imagine the conflicts and ideological currents of our current global conjecture through this threat of being made surplus, of being made disposable, fears of being made surplus or disposable that are, you know, for instance, animate the heinous racist ideologies of people who believe in, for instance, theories of white replacement, which has so recently inspired so many terrorists to attack people in the name of their sort of vicious ideology, themselves performing a kind of act of human sacrifice to their own strange god.
You spoke earlier about, you know, the ubiquitous nature of palm oil in so many things that we buy in supermarkets and pharmacies today. But in the 19th century, as you make clear, those were not the primary uses by Europeans of palm oil. And yet you argue that palm oil was central to the Industrial Revolution. What were Europeans using palm oil for in the 1800s? And when did the market for palm oil emerge?
Well, initially, European entrepreneurs did try and introduce palm oil as a replacement fat to the European proletariat. Because as the removal of people from their land made more and more working class people flood into cities, there was a great shortage of animal fats, which were the staple of European diets up to that point. And so it would have made sense for them to try and have the working classes eat palm oil that could be imported much more cheaply based on the exploitation of African labor. However, because palm oil at the time was used as grease for railways, which, you know, most people would have seen at some point, an engineer smearing it on the axles and wheels of railway engines and cars, it proved to be an unappetizing choice for most people. But it found many other uses in Europe during the 19th century. So in addition to being a grease for railway cars and locomotives, it also was a key lubricant for the Industrial Revolution and the steam engines that would be found in factories and other facilities. It greased the wheels of steamships, such as the steamship that carried the troops of the British Empire into the heart of the Edo Kingdom when they embarked upon their punitive expedition. It was also used in the manufacture of tin cans. It was used in the manufacturing of candles and the manufacturing of soap as well. And all of these were sort of major applications for palm oil. Now, importantly, a number of the things that I've just mentioned, notably tin cans, candles, and soap, these were the real consumer commodities of the 19th century. They were things that up to this point had been quite expensive and suddenly became quite cheap. And as a result, European capitalists began aggressive advertising campaigns, the kind of progenitors of today's advertising industry, to encourage consumerism. And a lot of those campaigns encouraged the European working class and middle class to identify with empire and palm oil as the fruit of the empire. And indeed, they would often advertise by using images that depicted the palm oil industry as benevolent towards Africans. It was suggested that by creating a market for palm oil in Europe, consumers could help drive out dark and barbaric practices that were associated in the racist imagination with Africa. It was imagined that this honest and noble commerce of growing peaceful palm trees would and tapping them for or harvesting their fruits for palm oil and refining it would alleviate that continent's dependency on enslaved labor even after the abolition of the transatlantic slave trade, and that it would lead to Christianization and the notion of, you know, a hard day's work, which Europeans fancied that they knew something about and that Africans didn't. So ultimately, in the 19th century, not only did palm oil grease the literal wheels of the empire, it also in some ways greased the ideological wheels of the empire as well.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Max Haven, H-A-I-V-E-N, joins me. He is Canada Research Chair in the Radical Imagination at Lakehead University, where he co-directs the Reimagining Value Action Lab. And we are discussing his new book, Palm Oil, The Grease of Empire. We've talked about how palm oil was used as a grease for industrial machinery, but you also discuss in your book, Palm Oil, The Grease of Empire, how it was literally, this substance was literally weaponized. It was turned into weapons of empire. What kind of weapons?
Well, one of the earliest weaponized application was the production of dynamite. Dynamite is a combination. It's built on the basic chemical processes of nitroglycerin, which mixes nitrates with glycerin, which is a derivative from fat processing and often soap making. And in the 19th century, dynamite manufacturers, notably Alfred Nobel and his company, after whom the Nobel Prize is named, would have found a cheap and ready supply of very purified glycerin in the byproducts of the palm oil industry. So quite literally, the dynamite that destroyed so many European cities in the subsequent century and was used to blast open mountain faces to open new vistas for railways or new mining activities around the world was literally made, perhaps, out of palm oil. This was one application and a weaponization. It was also at the later point in the 19th century, at the around the time of the invasion of Benin, which I mentioned before, the Edo Kingdom, it was part of a great race between different empires to find a universal gun oil that could keep European weapons lubricated and cleaned in tropical environments where the empire was increasingly seeking to extract resources and facing a huge amount of resistance. And later on in the 20th century, during World War II, labs in the United States were to develop palm oil into the weapon that still bears its name, which is napalm, a kind of jellied gasoline substance, which, you know, as became famous in the Vietnam War, stuck to the skin and created horrific, debilitating burns on its victims when it didn't kill them outright. But napalm was also envisioned as the kind of perfect, if horrific, tool of what the Americans euphemistically called counterinsurgency, which would probably be better called the wars that empires fight against decolonial and anti-colonial forces. It was particularly useful in this way because not only did it stick to the skin and create horrific burns, but it also could be used to target civilian populations that might be supporting so-called insurgents, and also could be used as an element in deforestation and war against the landscape, which, you know, guerrilla fighters were using operationally to better their chances of fighting against these huge empires.
The British and Dutch empires eventually transplanted, they moved oil palms from plantations in West Africa to Southeast Asia, to what are today Indonesia and Malaysia, countries that now are palm oil superpowers in a sense. I think those two countries together account for something like 70 to 80% of palm oil exports globally. Why did these two empires, the British and Dutch, move these plantations to Southeast Asia, and what were the consequences for workers and for the environment?
As the 20th century dawned, both of these empires began to aspire to new markets, and their foothold in Indonesia and Malaysia became deeper, largely thanks to advances in shipping, including on steamships, which were often greased, their engines were often greased with palm oil. They were also expanding into Asian and American markets via the Pacific, so there were broad new vistas to explore. And already both of these countries were being opened up as spaces for the harvesting of timber, underground minerals, but also other cash crops like rubber, exotic fruits and spices, and more. And palm oil was one of the many crops that the planter class, who became fabulously wealthy in that region, was seeking to extract. It was also a region where imperial powers were able to play local populations off against each other, who had been divided across lines of ethnicity, language, religion, which opened up vast new sources of exploitation of dispossessed and displaced laborers in the region, whether they were displaced indebted workers from India or different ethnic groups that have been forced to move throughout the Southeast Asian region. So it offered a very lucrative opportunity for entrepreneurs and investors to turn to cash crops, including palm oil.
You write about palm oil today in the current conjuncture as the fat of the world's poor, a commodity that feeds so-called surplus populations that have been separated from the land and the capacity to produce food for themselves, and who are now dependent on cheap commodities like palm oil for survival. And you link the fears and hostility of elites toward these surplus populations to the politics of body fat, which, as you point out, disproportionately affects poor people. So how are these two things, surplus population and fat phobia, connected in the story that you're telling about palm oil?
Yeah, I mean, just to start with the big picture, I think both are elite fears about there being too much of other people. Whether it's too many other people, that there's this kind of surplus population, these myths of overpopulation, or whether it's people who have too much weight, too much flesh, that somehow can't control themselves. And in both cases, it draws on a long legacy of elite discourse and elite thinking that suggests that something must be done about the abundance of the other. Now, in the first case, we have palm oil as a signifier of this problem that goes back to the European colonial projects, as well as the sort of elite project of enclosing the commons. Centuries ago, before the kind of capitalist restructuring of the world system, most humans lived on or very near land that grew their food. And as part of that, humans have various interactions with fat, which is an incredibly important part of our bodies, an incredibly important part of our diets. What happened as capitalism develops is that the manufacturing of many foodstuffs, including fat, becomes detached from a kind of social base. More and more workers are forced into cities where they become wage laborers, forced to depend on their work for others to buy the means by which they can sustain themselves. And as this happens, fats, ironically, often become cheaper in the sense that high-fat foods often become the foods that poor people can afford, rather than, as they were perhaps in the Middle Ages, foods that were emblematic of the wealth and profligacy of the rich. So on the one hand, we have this situation where I think especially today, the malady of obesity as an epidemiological fact, as something that affects populations, is a malady that disproportionately affects poor people, because it's poor people who are often left only to be able to afford highly processed foods that are high in unhealthy fats, who are denied the time or the opportunity or the resources to cook healthier foods for themselves, or who simply are looking for something that tastes good after a very hard day of work. So on the one hand, we have this problem. But on the other, we have this strange neoliberal ideology that suggests that fat on a human body is a sort of signifier of a person's ineligibility to be a kind of full social participant. It's held to symbolize that that person is not capable of controlling themselves, that they've been overindulgent, or that they've been taking too much from the common pot. And so in a sense, there's a double movement here where poor people are increasingly those who are suffering from obesity and overweight categorization as it's developed by the medical system we have today, thanks in part to the cheapness of commodities like palm oil and the processed foods that it furnishes. And at the same time, poor people are blamed for their own misfortune and in some ways declared to be failed subjects of the capitalist economy precisely because they carry this weight on them. And in any case, what both of these discourses do is place back in the hands of elites in the capitalist class and its intellectual functionaries the right, even the duty, as they imagine it, to try and imagine how to intervene and control populations in order to produce maximal health outcomes or in order to control populations. And these can range from well-meaning but useless, as many attempts are to either control populations or to control people's body weight. But often they can also stray into the extremely damaging and damning, including modern forms of eugenics that imagine that, you know, populations need to be controlled in order to better society, or interventions that are extremely punitive towards people who are deemed to be fat by the system.
That's the voice of Max Haven, writer, teacher, Canada Research Chair in the Radical Imagination at Lakehead University in Thunder Bay, Canada, where he co-directs the Reimagining Value Action Lab, that is a workshop for the Radical Imagination, Social Justice, and Decolonization. He's the author of several books. His new one, what we are talking about today, is called Palm Oil, The Grease of Empire. We have a link to Max Haven's website and to palm oil on our website, againstthegrain.org. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. The book also brings up the example of ramen noodles, which usually have a lot of palm oil in them. And you point out that this quintessentially cheap food has become a staple for migrant and otherwise exploited workforces and populations around the world. And you note its importance to China's Great Migration, so-called Great Migration, from rural villages to urban centers since the 1990s, which some people say constitutes the largest movement of humans in world history. And you take up in your book, Palm Oil, the example of how ramen noodles have become important in the informal economies created by incarcerated people in the U.S. prison system. What is the significance of ramen noodles, and why do you focus on it?
I think they're such a charismatic example of the global food system, largely because we all have experienced them. Most of us have eaten them at some point. They're very popular among children. And they're a quintessential cheap food. I mean, if you're talking to your friends about not having any money, you might mention that you're eating ramen noodles. You know, they're an easy way to get calories from enriched wheat flour and usually palm oil, although sometimes other vegetable oils like soy bean oil will suffice. I focus on it for that reason, and also because I think we can trace a number of shifts that have happened and the role palm oil has played in more recent times. You know, I talked earlier about the way that palm oil greased the wheels of industrial capitalism. In a certain way, palm oil still greases the wheels of capitalism in the 21st century, but the needs of capitalism are shifting away from the kind of rapid and drastic industrialization of that age and towards the needs that include the management of populations. And here I take the two examples that you mentioned. On the one hand, ramen noodles became extremely popular from the 1980s, especially the late 1980s, up until the present, as millions of young Chinese workers moved from the rural countryside to mostly coastal cities to take up works in that country's burgeoning industrial sector. And here, their labor and their ability to produce was literally powered with through palm oil, in the sense that they were eating these ramen noodles and metabolizing them into energy, which they would then literally put into the commodities that would be sold around the world, commodities including the computers and devices that we're using to speak to one another, for instance, but many others besides. So on the one hand, I wanted to note that palm oil still plays this important role in lubricating capitalism, although capitalism has shifted. The other example I wanted to bring up is of its role, the ramen noodle, in the American prison system, or the gulag system, as Ruth Wilson Gilmore puts it, where essentially incarcerated people who, as we know, are disproportionately Black and Latinx and poor and working class people are increasingly being made to survive on ramen noodles. Now, if you look at the meals that are served to incarcerated people in American prisons, almost all of the food that's served to them also includes a huge amount of palm oil, white bread from sort of major bread manufacturers, processed cheese, drink mixes, processed cookies, all the things that might be served in a typical bagged lunch for a prisoner involve palm oil to begin with. But often those meals, and including the processed meats, I should mention as well, but those meals are often not enough to feed imprisoned people. And those people need to look for other sources of nutrition. And one of the consistent ones that has been offered by prison commissaries at an extremely high markup is ramen noodles. And this led in various ways for it to become a key currency among incarcerated people within prisons. It's fungible in the sense that one package of ramen noodles is very much like another. It holds its value over a relatively long period of time because there's so many preservatives in the packages that it can be stored, it can be accumulated, can be used sort of as a store of value and a means of exchange. So it fulfills many of the functions that economists attribute to money. But I think underneath that is a horrific story about what happens to a population that is essentially being managed, a population that has been rendered surplus by the capitalist economy and is now being managed by the state and corporations for other people's profit. And so the ramen story helps us see how palm oil remains bound up in that story as well.
NGOs, non-governmental organizations, and other groups in the global north have been trying to call attention to and confront the evils of the palm oil industry, and you present in your book a sort of, well, what you call a friendly critique of the efforts of these organizations. You argue that while well-meaning, these initiatives often target the consumer in the global north. So the effort is to try and encourage consumer activism like boycotts or petitions. What do you find disturbing or wrongheaded about these kinds of approaches?
Well, first let me say that I certainly get it. I think if you're working for one of these large non-governmental organizations like Greenpeace or Rainforest Action Network or Amnesty International, all of whom have done excellent work revealing the evils of the palm oil industry, you're always looking for a hook to get people interested. And that hook often involves the way that we encounter palm oil every day in so many products. So my critique is friendly because I don't want to undercut what these groups are doing. But I do want to note that there is some problems with it. One of them is that we can't help now but hear the echo of those campaigns in the 19th century we spoke about earlier, where European consumers were encouraged to imagine that by essentially voting with their wallets, as we would put it today, or by making consumer choices, they could improve the lives of poorer people than them on the other side of the world. That ambition, that idea, the way that that frames the relationship between people, rehearses a certain kind of colonial ideology, which suggests that we in the developed, quote-unquote, civilized North or West, depending on how you want to frame it, have some sort of responsibility to improve the lives of those in the so-called East or the so-called South, which of course immediately creates a kind of ideological hierarchy. And that hierarchy has long, deep, and dangerous roots to it. The second problem, though, is that it encourages us to imagine that the limits and the proper way of imagining our agency in the world, our capacity to change the world, is through being a consumer. Now, that's very familiar to most people in the global North because we are constantly being addressed as a consumer through the advertising industry. We're very familiar with identifying ourselves and our agency through our ability to spend money. But that fundamentally reinforces a kind of neoliberal capitalist ideology that would insist that the only way to change the world is through the use and manipulation of money. And the problem with that, of course, is first that it's fundamentally limiting in the sense of what we can do, and second that it places incredible power in the hands of those who have money and practically no power in the hands of those who don't have a lot of money. And as we witness around the world and in each country a growing gap between rich and poor, essentially what we're saying when we accept the idea that consumerism is the means, is the best and proper means for our activism, is that we're willing to cede most of power in our society to an increasingly lawless and tiny elite of people who've been enriched by this very system. I think the alternative is to think a little bit more broadly and encourage everyone to think a little bit more broadly about how we live in a deeply entangled world and the way that that begs of each of us a deeper engagement with the world around us than simply choosing to buy product A instead of product B at the grocery store, or simply signing a petition, or simply, you know, flexing our consumer muscle. To the extent that we're only ever encouraged to flex our consumer muscle, or only encouraged to engage with these questions around economics and politics at the ballot box every 4 years, we're fundamentally ceding our power to forces that don't have our best interests at heart and are, in fact, destroying the planet.
I'm joined today by Max Haven, a writer, teacher, co-director of the Reimagining Value Action Lab, author of books like Art After Money, Money After Art, Cultures of Financialization, and Crises of Imagination, Crises of Power. His new book is Palm Oil, The Grease of Empire. It's published as part of the Vagabonds series of Pluto Press. You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. A recent proposal was put forward for a, quote, just transition in the palm oil industry. Give us some of the details of that proposal and why you say in your book that it could be important.
The Just Transition Plan has been authored by a group of campaigners, activists, academics, journalists, and others who've been working in solidarity with palm oil affected communities for a number of decades. These include indigenous groups who've been affected by palm oil plantations. They include workers groups, migrant workers groups, and environmental groups on the ground, mostly in Southeast Asia, in Indonesia and Malaysia, but also in Latin America as well. And I think what's come out of that long consultation is a scheme that actually begins a transition away from palm oil as an export-oriented crop that places those affected communities that are typically disempowered and devoiced at the center of the question. And what that looks like is beginning with the fundamental understanding that there is no way to have a sustainable palm oil industry despite what the palm oil industry claims. If and when that palm oil industry is based on cutting down tropical forests in order to grow more oil palm in industrial monocrop ways to feed an ever-growing global market. The Just Transition Plan suggests that it is indeed true that communities may choose to grow oil palm and export palm oil, but only as one of many crops that they might harvest for their own use and for commercial purposes, and that this economic motive would exist alongside and in dialogue with the needs of communities, the needs of the land. It would sort of issue from taking deep and serious consideration of indigenous knowledge. It would place the needs and the well-being of workers and their communities first. And what that would essentially mean is that this commodity, which has become artificially cheapened under capitalism, would become necessarily much more expensive because less of it would be produced. And it would be produced in situations that don't externalize the costs onto people and the planet. What I find most important for our purposes of the Just Transition Plan, for those of us who are in non-palm oil producing regions but are palm oil consumers, is that it would then demand of us that we reimagine the world and reimagine how to meet our needs without cheap palm oil. So what would that mean for the way that we wash our clothes? What would that mean for the way that we prepare our meals? What would that mean for the way that we rely on palm oil for all sorts of other industrial manufacturers? We would need to be content with the fact that many prices would increase, and in order to meet our needs, we would probably need to relocalize production of many things that today we simply rely on cheap palm oil to suffice for us. And I think that implies a very radical demand. It's not simply about being a consumer and making a better consumer choice about whether you're going to buy this product or that product. It also implies that we need to reimagine, for instance, how we're going to produce fat in our communities, how we're going to produce cleaning products in our communities, and slowly detach ourselves from an exploitative global economy so that we can re-globalize, but in a grassroots way, rather than a way that's controlled by large corporations and the profit motive.
And what you said leads nicely into my final question, which has to do with the fact that even though your story, the story you're telling about palm oil in your book, can be, you know, rather depressing and sobering, your book contains a note of optimism. You argue that this story also reveals something about our potential to reimagine and remake the world together, and in fact, our responsibility to do that. So talk more about the basis of this claim of yours, that there's really something heartening or something productive that can come out of a story of dispossession and exploitation.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to find something optimistic to say about such a horrible industry, which has withstood so many attempts over the last decades by NGO campaigners and by workers and indigenous groups to stand up to it. I mean, the palm oil industry is incredibly powerful and has been incredibly resilient, and unfortunately is gaining a new lease on life as the global price of oil goes up thanks to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which has thrown into havoc the sunflower oil markets as well. So we're going to see yet more ecological devastation in the name of meeting the market for palm oil, or for cooking oils and other oils in the near future. So it's hard to find something optimistic to say, but the optimism that I have comes from zooming out to a certain extent from this picture and seeing it as if from a great distance, and then zooming back in. If we zoom out far enough, what we see is that essentially a package of ramen noodles is the incredible materialization of solar power through the medium of human labor in cooperation with an oil palm. By which I mean that thing that comes to us in that package, the palm oil that's in it, is the result of the way that solar radiation is transformed by an oil palm into a bunch of palm kernels. And then the way that humans have learned over centuries to take those kernels and turn them into this thing called palm oil, and then into this thing called ramen noodles in order to feed ourselves. What we see in the process that's created that now is a horrific scene of environmental devastation and human exploitation. But underneath that is the reality that as a cooperative species that has the ability to cooperate with one another and cooperate with other entities in the more than human world, animals, plants, rivers, ecosystems. We have an incredible power and an incredible responsibility to transform the world in which we live. Palm oil, in some ways, is a kind of dark or fractured example of our own power reflected back to us. But we could use that power otherwise. We have an incredible power and an incredible creative energy and potential to transform the world. If we are capable of taking a palm tree and turning it into a million different commodities that we use every day, we are more than capable of creating a new and different economic system that would allow us to meet everyone's needs in a way that produces health and abundance and hope, rather than immiseration and hopelessness and fear. And I think we can learn from the example of what we've done with this plant and our relationship with this plant and all of the things that the plant can make to give us some inspiration for the task we have ahead of us, which is a task that's monumental in human history, because rather than simply leaving the fate of this cooperation between humans and the more than human world up to the profit-oriented demands of the market that produces such horrific scenes of human and non-human sacrifice, we need to instead imagine that form of cooperation in egalitarian, democratic, peaceful, and ecologically resilient and sustainable ways. It's a huge task, and yet, in a certain way, underneath the story of palm oil is an example that shows us we have it within our powers.
Max Haven, again, H-A-I-V-E-N, a writer, Canada Research Chair in the Radical Imagination at Lakehead University, where he co-directs the Reimagining Value Action Lab, or RIVAL, author of books like Revenge Capitalism and Crises of Imagination, Crises of Power. We've been talking about his new book. It's called Palm Oil, The Grease of Empire. Thank you, Max, so much for writing this book and for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me again.
And that program first aired on June 14th of this year. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.